Many who read the polls might say 2024 looks like the year of living dangerously. No arguing who's got the momentum, only 4 days out from snap legislative elections here in France and on the eve of the first candidates' debate in the United States. French voters can argue that they've tried all the others, so why not the far right? Or that Marine Le Pen's party will be less Eurosceptic once confronted with the hard reality of governing. Kind of like what's happened in Italy. But then, how do we explain Donald Trump's brand of politics? He's not untested. On his watch, supporters tried to overturn the former U.S. president's electoral defeat by force back on January the 6th, 2021. Why does he have the momentum? Emmanuel Macron's been blasted for gambling away his relative majority on a snap election that doesn't give citizens enough time to reflect. Americans will have had 4 long years now to reflect. In both cases, are the one-third of voters solidly behind a Liberal Party's bigger risk-takers than Macron? Or do they feel that they've got nothing to lose? Today in the France 24 debate, we ask about the far-right surge. And joining us from Seoul in South Korea, thank you for staying up late, founder of the digital media Persuasion, which includes the Good Fight podcast, Yasha Monk, professor of international affairs at Johns Hopkins University. Good to see you. We're also joined by journalist Anne Bagamary, who is with us as well. How are you? We're blessed with two Americans in Paris, contributing editor to the Daily Beast, Craig Capitis. How are things?
I'm fine.
All right. You can, by the way, watch us or you can listen, like, and subscribe to the France 24 debate on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and other fine streaming services. Now, before we talk about France and the United States, look who's taking over the rotating presidency of the European Council. On July the 1st, Hungary's self-styled illiberal prime minister, Viktor Orban, making the rounds before his six-month turn begins. This was long scheduled. This Wednesday, it's Paris. Hungary, as a Viktor Orban, whose teams have come up with a catchy slogan, Anne Bagamary, make Europe great again. Your thoughts?
Well, if I were Donald Trump's image makers, I'd, you know, sue for plagiarism. He obviously thinks that's going to work. It's not entirely clear that it is. In my view, I think it's a little bit too soon to know whether MAGA is really going to carry the day in the U.S. It obviously has some momentum, but let's face it.
This influence of U.S. politics to the point where you can sort of lift a campaign slogan that's very American and use it in Hungary.
Well, since when has Europe not turned to America and followed closely everything that America does, much more so than America has followed Europe and everything it does? But what I think will be interesting to see is whether Orban takes it to the next level. In other words, is quite as bombastic, insulting, and aggressive in his politics in front of his EU partners as Donald Trump is in his, because the playbook for right-wing populists and demagogues here in Europe is very, very different. As you know, Marine Le Pen's party in France has not made gains because she was more of a fascist than her father. She has softened her message considerably, and that has directly led to more support. Giorgia Meloni in Italy, when she was elected, everybody was terrified that she was going to be more right-wing than the right-wing. And in fact, she did very well in the Brussels elections, unlike Macron, because her message is really more centrist. It may be all nonsense. Underneath it all, she may still be very, very sharply right-wing. But her message is much, much softer, and that plays.
All right, be less shouty if you're a European. You mentioned Giorgia Meloni before Paris. Viktor Orban was in Rome on Tuesday. His call for greatness endorsed by Italy's far-right prime minister, Giorgia Meloni. Let's take a listen.
Thank you.
E voglio dire che apprezzo molto, condivido le priorità che sono state individuate.
I really appreciate and share the priorities that Hungary has set for its European presidency, starting from the decision to have among those priorities a challenge that I myself have highlighted many times, also in the context of discussing the European Union's areas of competence. I'm talking about the demographic challenge. It's a condition to be a great Europe, a Europe that is able to be a major player on the world stage again.
Sappia tornare a essere protagonista nel mondo.
Make more babies. Yasha Monk, your reaction to that?
There is a serious demographic crisis in many countries around the world. I'm currently in Korea, which is probably the major nation in the world with the lowest fertility rate, lower than 1.0 babies per couple, according to some analysts, and so I think the question of how industrialized nations can replace their population with their own children is one that makes sense and is serious. When it is espoused in this kind of way by politicians who have roots in a post-fascist movement as part of a much broader fight about sort of what kind of culture should prevail. It sits a little bit less easily and speaks to a broader political shift in Europe that is perhaps more concerning. But it's another interesting slogan, like make Europe great again, for sure.
Don't read too much into it when Giorgia Meloni's extolling the virtues of having more children. It's not a throwback to what was a key platform in the 1930s.
I think certainly there were fascist governments in the 1920s, 1930s, but we're talking about that. But of course, Emmanuel Macron in France introduced a big program that was meant to boost French demographic growth recently. And, the underlying problem is one that I do think is real and one that is interestingly universal. I mean, there are some conservatives and some far-right wingers in Europe and in North America who worry that the low fertility rates in countries like the United States or in France are sort of one element of Western decline or Western decadence or a problem of liberalism. But the truth of it is that the same problem exists in many countries around the world. At this point, Mexico is below replacement. India is around the replacement rate. The Islamic Republic of Iran has fertility way below the replacement rate. So this is not quite the main topic we're talking about today, I think, but the question of how to get industrialized, affluent societies to have healthy levels of population growth is, I think, a serious one, whoever happens to utter it.
We can now welcome to our conversation Paul Mason, columnist for The New European, the author of How to Stop Fascism. Thanks for joining us here in the France 24 debate. And these far-right parties in Europe and in the United States appealing to a greatness that once was?
Look, one of their appeals is nostalgia, but I think we have to be honest and clear and say that whether it's in my country with the convergence of this reform UK party with the far right, or whether it's Trump in America, the driver is often migration. Now, I am on the left side of politics. I support migration. I want to celebrate the multicultural nature of the Britain. I live in here in London. But I have to acknowledge that Brexit was driven by people's opposition to migration. And I see the rise of Rassemblement National in France as also being driven by migration. So we on the left and liberal side of politics have to come up with a defense of a multicultural society, but a realistic policy that understands why people are so concerned, because in the end, they look at the limited resources, the limited healthcare places, the limited housing, and they say, well, good though migration might be for staffing an elderly people's home or a hospital or a restaurant, in the end, it places pressure on resources. And I don't think the left and liberalism have come up with an answer to that that is convincing people who are moving to the right.
Craig Kapitis, you agree with that?
No, I think we sound like a bunch of chickens chattering in the churchyard. Anne said the key word, playbook. Well, let's go to the playbook and see what the playbook has to say about Orban, Maloney, Le Pen, Fartage, and Trump. Oh, guess what? They're fascists. So there we go.
Why? Yeah, but hold on. The question here is lowering birth rates. The concern over immigrants.
That doesn't interest me in the least. And that's fine. There are people who need to discuss lowering birth rates.
But we're trying to explain why there's this surge.
I can explain why. It's not lowering birth rates. Discussing lowering birth rates at this point in the program.
Or concern about migration.
Or in detail, we're talking about policy. It's gone beyond policy. There are many right now who do not know they are fascists, but they're going to find out when the time comes. And what you're looking at here is we try to go into this policy, but I'm saying beware the awkward and aggrieved, you know, racist, feral racist right-wing wingnuts who we see out there right now. And we have a reluctance to talk about, a reluctance to go after these people, tell the public who they are and what they are. But we go back to these safe zones. Let's talk about birth rates. It's a legitimate point. Don't get me wrong. If you want to talk about that, fine. But I don't care about it because that's not the real issue here. The success of these people lies in their flattering and kowtowing to the undereducated, the uneducated. Oh, we'd better not say that on TV. But Trump said that last year in Nevada. You could roll the videotape. He said, I love uneducated people, Trump said. So that's what we're dealing with here. That's the issue. And discussing birth rates and all of that, fine, go right ahead. But I just find that about a lot of
chattering
chickens.
So hold on, you're saying 33% of the French who, according to the polls, might cast a ballot for a far-right candidate this coming Sunday are uneducated?
Yes. Yes, I am.
Anne Begemery, your thoughts?
Let's say undereducated.
Well, not going to be drawn on calling parts of the electorate uneducated. That has proven bad for politicians and also really bad for pundits, which I am at the moment. So I will just pick up on some of the threads we've been talking about and say that what you can see in France, what you can see in the U.S. with Trump, what you can see even in the U.K. with Farage, who, honest to God, really, the U.K. is a two-party system. He's a fringe party candidate, everywhere but in his own mind. What you're seeing is people who are eager to break things. There are voters that are eager for change. I mean, there are some very mainstream publications like the Washington Post that have said that the winner of tomorrow night's debate will be the candidate, and the winner of the election in the U.S. is going to be the candidate who promises to bring change. There are a lot of different ways to affect change. The populists, let's not say fascists, but the populists are the ones who are looking at a charismatic leader who will tell them, I can fix this, we just have to go break the institutions and tear it down and try something new.
Isn't that what we saw in 2017 with Emmanuel Macron?
We did indeed. And that is why it's a little scary now, 7 years later, to arrive at this position, which probably many people saw coming, where you can't just decide to tear something down for the right reasons. You're going to tear it down. Now we have a Macron center-left, center-right party that hasn't built from the outside in or even from the inside out. And you've got two left wings who claim, anyway, to have the monopoly on wisdom about what France needs.
Yasha Monk, you had a conversation with the French sociologist Olivier Roy in which you discussed this very point. In 2017, Macron effectively blows up the big tent center-left and center-right parties, but doesn't build a party of his own. Why?
Yes, so look, there's two points here. The first is about the impact that Macron has had on the political system. He clearly managed to replace the center-left and the center-right parties in France, the Parti Socialiste and what's now called the Républicain, by having a dominant performance at that election, by building a lot of support and not leaving room for these parties. But that created a huge problem for the center, because sometimes governments get deeply unpopular, and French governments very often get deeply unpopular. And what you want to happen then is that people get upset with the center-left government and say, all right, we'll vote in the center-right and give them a chance. And then at some point, the center-right government runs out of steam, makes some mistakes, and people say, you know what, frankly, there's this other team of people who've reformed themselves in the meanwhile and who've gotten some better ideas and perhaps ditched some unpopular ideas. Let's give them a chance for a little while. That way you can go back and forth. By creating one big centrist bloc and tying it to his own personality and his own popularity, Macron ceded a situation in which people would feel that they no longer have an alternative within the center, because the center-left and the center-right is effectively dead, and Macron, for various reasons, is deeply unpopular. So what they have left on one side La France Insoumise and the new Popular Front that they have built, the coalition that goes a little bit from the center-left to a dominating far-left, and then on the right, they have left the Rassemblement National. I would, François, if you allow me, also like to respond to a very animated colleague in the studio. You've been running the show for a good long while, and you know that I've been coming on the show for a good long while, and I have warned about the danger of the kinds of populists that we're discussing today a good many times on this program and elsewhere. I continue to be very concerned about Donald Trump in the United States, about Viktor Orban in Hungary, about all of these different political figures. But if there's one thing I learned in 10 years of going around the world, including to Korea, where I happen to be right now, to warn about these populists, it's that ratcheting up how shrill we are in criticizing them and just ratcheting up in how much opprobrium we heave on their supporters is not going to make a difference. We have been sounding the alarm bell for 10 years. And if it looks like Donald Trump may very well be reelected in the United States, and if it looks like the Rassemblement National is now in the best position to have the largest bloc, perhaps a majority in the Assemblée Nationale in France, the reason is not that wonderfully educated journalists, political scientists haven't been loud enough in disapproving of the populists. So I think we need to ask ourselves some slightly more self-critical questions about why it is that people are voting for these political forces and what changes we need to make in order for that to cease being the case. Simply, reaching for the most shocking possible term in describing them and doing so with the most possible animation is sadly not going to solve this very real problem.
Craig Capitis, point taken.
I couldn't agree more with what Yasha just said. But I think what he's forgetting here is that there's absolutely no way that we are going to convince these cultists otherwise. They're going to go along with these people no matter what we say, no matter what good deeds anyone might try. The job, as I see it now, is that it is, look, the costliest of all follies is to believe passionately in what's palpably not true. And the rhetoric coming out of these right-wing dingoes is palpably not true. Fascism comes in many shapes, sizes, colors, and aromas. It's all different, you know, and this is what we're dealing with here now. That's the reality. But I'm not going to be nice to these people. At the very best, they're undereducated. And their question for me is, why are they undereducated?
Paul Mason, let me bring you in on this, because you penned a piece for the New European entitled "If the Tories Are Crushed." And by the way, we now somehow it's been upstaged. There's an election in the UK between the two rounds of the French legislative elections. If the Tories are crushed, they'll be replaced by something even worse. You're saying the Tories who have been chasing since Brexit after the populist vote.
Yeah, what's happened both in the UK and across the world is that we once thought that the far-right populists, people like Le Pen, people like Trump, would in some way be a firewall against fascism. What's happened is that their thought patterns and the thought patterns of their parties have converged with fascism. We see it here in the United Kingdom. Reform UK is this Nigel Farage's new party. It's now drawing a lot of support away from the Conservatives. Look, we don't stop that process by calling people uneducated. That's the first thing. We have to recognize that in many ways, people who have moved from conservatism to right-wing populism and are now playing with fascist ideology are taking rational decisions. What we need to do is dismantle their thought architecture, dismantle the logic of the way they're thinking. And I'm afraid this stuff about the birth rate plays into it. It's, you know, once they adopt the mindset of the famous Renard Camus book, the Great Replacement, the idea that migration is not just maybe a problem to be managed or something something that we need to adapt to, but it's an invasion. Once they frame it like that, the rest of the fascist thought process flows from that. So if I agree with the person in the studio that this is about reasoning with people, but it's not about insulting them. And what you're about to see in the United Kingdom is a social democratic attempt to solve that. Really, the Labour Party, which I'm part of, is in a way an alliance of everybody who would be in the Nouveau Front Populaire in France, plus some people who would be in Les Républicains and some people who would be in Ensemble. It's a recalibration of politics. And that is what I would urge my colleagues and friends in France to think about in the next few weeks. The real Popular Front, the real emulation of Léon Blum's 1936 government would be if the Nouveau Front Populaire found a way to ally with as many as possible of Macron's supporters. Going to be difficult, because they don't like each other, but neither did the centre in France in the 1930s really like the communists. It's just that they realised doom lay at the other side. So I think we're talking about the debate tomorrow in the USA. The Democrats know they've got to do the same thing. They have to reach out, no matter how few and how antagonistic they think they are, they have to reach out to potential Republican voters. And you don't do it by calling them stupid, and you don't do it by writing off their concerns about migration. You have to show that you've got a better solution. And I believe here in the United Kingdom on the 4th of July, amazingly, that we're voting on Independence Day, we should be able to do that. The polls are now predicting an absolutely massive landslide for Keir Starmer's Labour. And I can tell you, because I've been out on the doorsteps campaigning, the reason for that is that Starmer has overcome the antipathy of that centre-right voter to the left proposition by neutralising immigration, so that only the far-right are using immigration. The centrist voter is now focused on health, they're focused on education, they're focused on the good jobs that net zero could bring if we do it right. And I think if Biden wants to win, that's what he's got to do.
I have a quick question for Paul. What if we're all wrong? What if the public, the voting public, majority, they want to elect fascists? We ever thought about that?
Yeah. I mean, that's where Hitler was elected. You know, he didn't win the election that brought him to power, but Hitler was the biggest party.
And why doesn't that scare the bejesus out of everyone?
It should, but we're not yet there in most places. I think we were nearly there in Brazil. We're nearly there in Brazil, but we dodged a bullet. I think we were nearly there at the last American election, because Trump moved from kind of fascist curious to advocating and tolerating insurrectionaries. And I think my big fear for the US general election is not that Trump wins, but that Trump loses narrowly once again. Mm-hmm. And this time, you know, those voters will have voted for a guy who justifies insurrection.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a second. For many on this side of the Atlantic, it felt like a Civil War moment on January 6, 2021. Supporters storming the Capitol, trying to stop the certification of his loss in the presidential election. At a rally in Las Vegas earlier this month, Donald Trump hailed those January 6th warriors, J6 warriors, as he calls them. They were warriors, he said, but they were really more than anything else victims of what happened. All they were doing, Anne Bagot Mary, was protesting a rigged election, end quote.
Okay, imagine my shock that an election Donald Trump lost he considered rigged.
But calling the people who stormed the Capitol warriors.
You're talking about him inciting to violence and casting this in bellicose terms and so on and so forth.
The question everyone on this side of the Atlantic wonders is how come the race is so close in the U.S.?
They're not Americans. I mean, the playbook, to use the word again, the playbook here is very, very different. I mean, even in France, where you had leaders as disparate as Mitterrand and Chirac talking about their issues and taking off the gloves to fight each other, there was a core that was never really in question, and that was the French institutions and the French system. They agreed on that. Now, Donald Trump's view of how to win votes, it has nothing to do with upholding American institutions. It has to do with tearing things down. And I think, I mean, we were talking before about lots of different issues that can motivate people to get scared about the future. What about the economy? We're not talking about, I mean, Paul mentioned a little bit about buying power, the purchasing taxes. That's a big issue in Britain, and you're seeing a landslide for Labour predicted. Once the issues come down to the economy, and I think they'll come down very, very quickly in the debate tonight and also in the two elections we've got coming up here in France, you're going to see people focusing on that a lot more carefully. And I think let me just ask you,
because there is an Ipsos poll out for the Reuters news agency. When asked which of the two candidates had a better approach for the economy, this is a poll that was conducted late last week. Number one concern for respondents, registered voters picking 43% for Trump and 37 for Biden. Does that inform Paul Mason's view that people believe what they want to believe, or why is it this? And by the way, the Financial Times did a similar poll here in France. A full one quarter of the French trusted the national rally more on the economy than the
Maybe
others.
Maybe they're undereducated. Oh, excuse me.
Have they read the platform? Have they read the National Front's platform? Have they read the left's platform? Which is both of them about spending, spending, spending. On the right, you're talking, this is in France, you're talking about cutting taxes. And on the left, they're not talking about raising them at all. One of the biggest weak points of France at this point is its economy. It is already out of the lane with the EU in terms of deficit as a percentage of GDP. It's that close to being chastised and having to negotiate its budget.
Focus on the economy and everything will be okay.
What
I
economy?
Didn't say
Which
everything
economy?
Would be okay. I said that this was going to be a capital issue and we're not talking about it.
That's right. That's right. It's an economy. Oh, the economy that I don't have enough, that gas is too expensive in Po. Yes. But ask them, well, you know, you're 3 trillion euros in debt and growing. Oh, we don't care. And this is what the left here and the right is saying. Oh, we'll give you everything you want. Now, as you said, Ann, read the platforms. Read what they're saying. Yeah. It's clear. Why can't they see the reality here? And I think it comes back, and I'm sorry to repeat myself, they're undereducated. We cannot sugarcoat this anymore. They're buying into this nonsense from the right and left wing.
I would like to hear what Yasha, who spends a lot of time in the U.S., would say about the communication of the economic issues and the resonance that has in the U.S. with a range of voters, including those who responded.
Yasha Monk, 4% unemployment. Cost of living is high in the U.S., but if you're trying to go food shopping, it's gone up a lot for people who don't earn a lot. And but at the same time, inflation has steadied. So tell us.
Well, on the economy, I think it's simply a mixed picture. When you look at some of the people who use electoral forecasts, which focus on the fundamentals, including the economy, the kind of indicators that they have used for 30 or 40 years indicate a close election. Which is to say that there are some parts of the economy that are going very well. The very high employment rate is one part of that. There are actually reasonably good advances in nominal income, particularly at the lower end of wages, is a very positive sign. But there are also some general problems in the economy. And the biggest of that is that inflation has deeply eaten into people's sense of having had any improvement in their living standard. And of course, when economists measure inflation, they measure what were the prices like last month relative to what the prices were like year ago. Yeah. And that rate of inflation has indeed steadied and declined. But when ordinary people ask themselves about inflation, they say, well, hang on a second. Why is this thing in the supermarket 25% more expensive than it was 5 years ago? And a lot of Americans have not experienced an improvement in their living standards over those 25 years, over those 5 years. Now, the Biden campaign has insisted on doing something, but unfortunately in politics, often doesn't work very well. And that is to try to explain things to people, to say, you know what, actually the economy is great. And if you don't feel that it's great, we're just going to tell you that you're wrong and that you're an idiot, that you have to get on board with thinking the economy is great. But understandably, voters don't always respond very well to that. I just want to make two other points. One is, in response to Paul's excellent comments about the United Kingdom, I would point out one important differential between what is happening in Britain and what helps to explain Keir Starmer's very strong standing and the situation of France. And that is that in the United Kingdom, Keir Starmer has been very, very clear and very strategic in cutting off the deeply unpopular and toxic parts of the left of the Labour Party. Jeremy Corbyn, in this election, is standing in his seat in Islington North as an independent because he is no longer part of the Labour Party. He will likely, according to the latest polls, lose that race against the Labour Party candidate. So Keir Starmer has built a broad coalition, but one that deliberately excludes the left of the left because he realized that that is what he needed to do, both for decency, but also in order to actually appeal to those swing voters that are deeply disenchanted with the Tories, that don't usually vote for Labour, that need to be able to trust Labour to do a decent job. So in France, the problem is trahison by many forces, a trahison by parts of the centre-right that are aligning themselves with the far-right, but also a trahison, a failure to honour the long-standing democratic principles of the centre-left when Parti Socialiste went into bed with Jean-Luc Mélenchon and La France Insoumise when they gave those candidates much greater running power, much greater visibility than the recent polls would indicate they needed to. And basically put a lot of French people into the choice of either voting for a left led by Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who is the equivalent of Jeremy Corbyn and for good reason is deeply unpopular in the country, or Emmanuel Macron, who has become toxic for failures of his governance as well as mistakes during this election, or in the end, the Rassemblement National. So if you're going to build a broad coalition in France, I agree it should extend from the Parti Socialiste to the right of the Macron forces to perhaps the left of the Républicains. But I don't think it can include Mélenchon if you're asking people to get on board. Otherwise, you're shooting yourself in the foot. And the last thing I will just say is that part of believing in democracy has to be believed that ordinary citizens, most of the time, are decent people who are capable of decent political judgment. If you are so sure that ordinary voters, fascists, who are just stomping at the bit to vote for new versions of Hitler or Mussolini, I think it's very hard to achieve a consistent debate because then you're going to be justifying to yourself, throwing your lot in any set of establishments or any set of elite forces that are willing to dispense with democracy in order to save our institutions from the unwashed masses. That is not the way to defend substantial democracy or to have trust in the power of democracy.
I have a question for Paul Mason, because what we have seen with the national rally, and they had a big press conference a couple of days back where it was very light on specifics. In fact, the only specific they gave, Paul, was about lowering VAT on fuel tax from 20% to 5.5%. There's a feeling that the green transition has come at the expense of the working poor. It was the only thing they said, and that has resonated in a lot of areas where people feel as though there is this sense that they could fall into poverty. Over in the UK, what's the mood? I noticed, by the way, as well, that Keir Starmer's road to election seems to be about keeping his cards close to his chest. He's been criticized for being light on specifics when it comes to his own platform.
The conservative right and fascism in general are going to use, between now and the year 2050, they're going to use net zero as a leverage issue, as a wedge issue to beat the center and beat the left. They're going to say to working people, you're going to lose out. This is against you. This is against your lifestyle. In Finland, we see them say, this is about the logging lifestyle. You know, if you like to drive around in a big SUV with a chainsaw and cut down trees, this is an attack on you. So we have to understand, that the way to neutralize net zero as a far-right issue is to do what Biden did. And Biden has done. Biden says, every time I hear the word green, I say the word jobs. And this is what Starmer has effectively done. Green here is not about saving the environment. It's not really even about clean air. It's about jobs and investment. And I think that is the lesson. It doesn't get you over the line. It doesn't mean that people who want to vote right because they're opposed to migration are not going to vote right. But it removes the net zero issue from as a driver. Now, I wasn't in France. I didn't see that Rassemblement National press conference, but I couldn't understand what they're trying to do. What Macron, and by the way, I agree with your comments on the left, Yasha. As a leftist, I would be very happy to see Mélenchon out of the Nouveau Front Populaire. I think he's a net negative for the left. But I have to accept that's what it is. What I want to see the left centre do now is to agree that there is a concrete program of delivering net zero that doesn't mean working people lose out. And one other point I'd make on the economy, I think I'm afraid to say my country left the European Union. It was never in the Eurozone. But I do not think that the rules of the Eurozone are now accelerating the problem, both in France and in Germany, of the far right. If you are committed by treaty to austerity, and that's, I'm afraid, what the Eurozone treaty does, your hands are tied. And you saw France get downgraded by the credit ratings agencies because it's now, way above the Eurozone permitted band of debt to GDP. I want to see major reform of the Eurozone's criteria, because otherwise the Eurozone just becomes a meat machine for driving politics to the extremes. That's a problem I don't have in the UK, and neither does Biden, but it's a problem that you in France and indeed in the rest of the Eurozone are going to have to face up to.
Anne Begemary?
Well, as I said, read the platform of the two other parties that are contesting with Macron for the next legislature, and I think it's pretty clear that the EU still does have a lot of, I think it's a terrific idea to reform treaties that may not be working again. But I think that's next year's problem, and if not in 3 years. Mm. Right now, I don't think there's much you can do about that except live within the rules that you've agreed to.
But go ahead.
No, what I did want to say has to do with something that's been said on the panel in various different ways about talking in specifics and bringing issues down to a level where people will react to them and act on them. One of the things I remember most clearly about the last two presidential elections, where Marine Le Pen made it through to the second round and then came up against her opponents, in one case Macron, in another case Sarkozy, is that where the wheels came off the wagon for the RN, or whatever you're calling it now, was specifics on the economy. She had no plan. And it was actually relatively easy for her opponent to demolish her on that. And I think that's where they lost the election. I don't think you can really underestimate the ability.
Difficult difference is that this time it's legislative elections, so it's not one race, but 577 two-round races.
Look, this is a proxy war for the presidency in 3 years, and we all know that. And Macron knows that too, which is why he called the snap elections. He has said, I will rather give the keys to Matignon, in other words, the assembly, to another party now than give them the keys to the Élysée in 3 years. He knows this is a referendum on his presidency and his policies. And he's telling the French, put your money where your mouth is. So this is, yes, it's a legislative election, but it's about the presidency.
And it's more than that. I mean, Macron is on the record of saying, quote, I'm paraphrasing, that a far right or far left win here, what was his phrase? He said, it pushes the people towards civil war.
But is he being a fireman or a pyromaniac when he says that?
An arsonist. Setting a fire so he can heroically put it out.
My take on Macron is this. I mean, look, Macron has a lot of problems. We could do, you know, five shows on that. But the point is, at heart, Macron is a Democrat. He's not a fascist. And he woke up one morning, for whatever reason, saying, oh, my God, look at these people. They could possibly take over the National Assembly, screw up our economy, blah, blah, blah. We have to take these people out now. Go ahead and debate whether it was a good idea or a bad idea. That's Macron's motivation. It's the same motivation of a kind of...
So was he right to call this snap election?
I'm not in a position to say whether what the president of France is doing in this snap election is right or wrong. What I am in a position to say is the guy's got a lot of cojones, that the guy has realized there's a problem. He does not come out and call these people fascists. I talked to someone at the palace about this. And what the phrase that Macron likes to use is... far-right demagogues.
Right.
Paul, is far-right demagogues about as close you can get to calling someone an SOB fascist without actually getting there? You're the expert on the liturgy here. I would agree. I would say that it is. I know that my friend Umberto Eco says that it is. I know that Ernest Hemingway, who wrote about fascism, said that it is. But I don't know now. I don't know what the... I'm not a TikTok follower.
Paul Mason.
I think we're now past the stage where we have this bestiary of parties, you know, fascists, right-wing populists, national conservatives. What's happening is they converged on the same idea set. The only thing that characterizes fascism is it overtly advocates a violent end, the collapse of the global order into a worldwide racial war. I think that there are parties on the French right that qualify for the word fascist. For now, I'm happy to see Rassemblement National described as far-right dingbats. Yeah. But our problem is not categorizing them. The problem is that the dam wall has busted and that everything is flowing to the right. What I'd agree with you is that the ones we can't persuade, we have to defeat. You know, the word Popular Front is now out there in the French lexicon. You have to remember that the Popular Front was born in 1934 in a night of violence against the French Constitution by the far right. And the left and the center decided to defeat them. Likewise, here in my country, in 1936, about at the same time, we decided that we'd had enough of parading by fascists and violence by fascists who were targeting Jewish communities, and we said we're going to defeat them. I think it's a mixture of persuasion and mass mobilization. And what I think we're going to have to see, certainly in America, if Trump actually wins, then the whole future of the American Constitution is on the line. Leave aside NATO, which is a whole other problem.
Ian Yashamunk, because... Yeah. There is, in that same Reuters poll that I quoted, one statistic which you'll be interested in. Biden has the edge over Trump when it comes to political extremism and threats to democracies. Registered voters picking the Democrat over Trump when it comes to guaranteeing democracy, 39% to 33%. Not a wide margin, but still he's ahead. And of course, Yasha, the election in France, the election in the United States, they've yet to happen.
Yes, at the moment it does look like Donald Trump has the edge in the elections in the United States, not by a very wide margin, that most models by The Economist, by Nate Silver, just released today, seem to suggest that it is more likely than not that Trump will win, but certainly Biden has every chance of doing so instead. To go back to the broader theme of this debate, I do think that Biden's ability to beat Trump will depend on his ability to show American voters a few very straightforward things. Number one, that he is capable of being president for another 4 years. Here, the upcoming debate is going to be incredibly important. Number two, that he can take his distance in the way that Keir Starmer did from the very unpopular parts of the Democratic Party and more broadly the American media ecosystem, which is making people think Biden is not quite in charge of the administration. The people who are way to the left of where we, the average voters, are. Therefore, we don't really trust him. And then third, as Anne was suggesting, that Biden therefore convinces people that he is going to put more money in their pockets and actually increase their standard of living. The significance of this election in the United States may very well be whether or not we avert another concerted attack on America's democratic institution, may very well be the future of NATO. But the way to win this election is to focus on bread and butter issues, make clear that you have good concrete plans for improving people's lives, and distance yourself from the messages and parts of the political spectrum that are making democracy popular, not just among old white people, by the way, but as we're seeing in polls and crosstabs, among young voters, among Latino voters, among black voters, who have become very skeptical of the Democratic Party and the broader ecosystem it is a part of. The biggest democratic responsibility right now is not to wax lyrical about the dangers of fascism. It is to actually make an offer to voters that they are likely to take up, because the stakes are indeed high.
Right. And ahead of the U.S. elections, of course, is first round here on Sunday. The British vote next week, then second round again in France. I want to thank you, Yasha Monk, for being with us from Seoul. I want to thank Paul Mason in London, Anne Bagomary, Craig Capitis. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.